Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Sometimes in people's lives, something happens that changes them forever, especially when a child dies. In this edition of Radio Curious, we visit with Cindy Sheehan, the mother of Casey Sheehan, who was killed in the Iraq War shortly after he enlisted, about 7 years ago. This event changed her life in ways that has never occurred before. We visited with Cindy Sheehan by phone from her home in Northern California on March 16th, 2011. Cindy Sheehan, welcome to Radio Curious.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So tell us about your son, Casey Sheehan. I think this is where it all began.
Well, Casey was my oldest son. He was my oldest child. And he was a very, very calm, collected, moral, upright person. He went to mass almost as often as he could, even more than just on Sundays. He was a really devoted Catholic Christian. He loved his brother and his sisters and his family. And he was 24 years old when he was killed in Iraq before he had a chance to get married. And yeah, he was my son. He was one of the loves of my life, and he was just somebody that was very, just very easygoing and wonderful to be around.
What motivated him to join the U.S. military?
To get his college benefits.
But he never had the opportunity to receive those.
Right, obviously, he was killed before he got out of the military.
When he was killed, that changed your life. Can you tell us how?
Well, it changed my life in, many profound ways. I became a mother of three instead of a mother of four. The violence of having a child precede a parent in death is, especially if the child, is taken violently, is physically very, people who have had this happen know what I'm talking about. It's very physically harmful to a parent. And I suspect anybody you love deeply or are connected to, if they pass away, it's very hard. But this kind of loss is incalculable. And so, when Casey died, I was against the wars and I was against the policies of the American empire, but I didn't know how to do anything about it. After he was killed, I spent most of my time researching about what could I do to change that, to help other families from not having to go through what my family had to go through. And so instead of being, what I would say would be your average, American woman with a family and at some times three jobs to help survive and help keep our family covered with health insurance, and just busily going about all my children's activities, I became an activist against the wars, and my marriage of almost 30 years crumbled, so I became a single person after spending at least two-thirds of my life with Casey's father. And so this changed. My life just couldn't have changed more, I don't think.
Well, tell us what you did in your political activities that were new to you.
Oh, just about everything I've done. I mean, I thought before Casey was killed that voting was my only responsibility in, you know, the policies of my country and the trajectory of my country. I thought that my vote is what was the only thing that I had to do. And so even going to a march and holding a sign was new to me, from walking the halls of Congress to camping out in front of George Bush's house and camping on the lawn of the Washington Monument last year in March when Obama's been president, to traveling around the world, speaking to crowds of, you know, a few dozen to a few hundred thousand. Everything that I've done since Casey was killed has been something that's new, something that I've learned from, and to where it's grown to where I can actually, I'm still a learner, and I hope everybody's a learner until to the day that they can't learn anymore, but from being a student to being a teacher. And so it's just been, everything's just been brand new for me.
Can you tell us some of the important aspects of what you have learned?
Well, I've learned a lot about human nature. I've learned a lot about the nature and the politics of activism. I've been profoundly hurt by some of the things that have happened to me. I've been profoundly inspired, but I found out the hard way that many organizations that say that they, you know, that said that they wanted peace and wanted an end to the wars, really just wanted an end to the Bush administration and the rule of the Republicans. And once that happened, they were, you know, they were satisfied and their activism turned elsewhere. So I've learned that these problems that we have in the world, in the United States, are not partisan problems. They're nonpartisan. And if we look at what's happening through, you know, the myopia of a two-party system. When I say two-party system, I'm doing air quotes that you can't see. You know, if we only look at it through that way, then we're never going to change just these deep, deep, deep systemic problems that we have here in the United States.
Tell us then what you would suggest as a political mechanism or a political system for the United States to deal with these issues.
Well, I think that, you know, what we can do in the grassroots is to think out, like I said, think outside the Democratic or Republican Party and look at these issues like they're, you know, they're issues. They're not political issues. They're human rights issues. They're environmental issues. They're, you know, we don't have to filter them through the Democratic Party. And so we have to get over our fear of, you know, using our integrity and our humanity and our courage to vote for somebody that really resonates with us, not someone whom we think is the lesser of two evils. And that is, I think, when I travel the country and talk to people, that's the hardest thing for people to internalize, that there is a different way, that you don't have to keep voting for these scoundrels, that we could support. And it's not like we have to reinvent the wheel. There have been some amazing candidates with amazing platforms that really, I think, resonate with most of the Democratic Party base, that they're too afraid that if they vote for someone with integrity, that they're going to get someone who's just by inches and degrees worse than the candidate that they're voting for. Another thing we have to realize is that we have a bigger effect on local politics and local activism and local issues than we do on national and international issues. And I know that worrying about and working for federal elections seems more glamorous, but if we really want to do the hard work of change, we have to work locally.
speaking of the national issue, we know the majority of Americans supported Barack Obama and, in fact, elected him. Are you implying that there's disappointment?
I know that there's disappointment in the people who supported him and the people who worked for him and donated money to him and voted for him. There's a lot of disappointment. I know that there's still a lot of denial in his supporters thinking that, you know, somehow, you know, he's better than the last administration or the administration before that or before that. But no, I know that there's a lot of disappointment, a lot of hurt, and a lot of anger in the people who supported Obama.
Let's talk about how local political activism can affect the national scale. Obviously, there's the election for congressional representatives, of which you were a candidate recently. But beyond that, how would you address that?
I don't think that working for a congressional candidate is local. That's federal. And there, I learned in my congressional run, and if people want to go to my website, CindySheehanSoapbox.com, I wrote a book after my campaign called Myth America, M-Y-T-H America. And it basically dispels these myths, and some of them are related to federal elections. You, unless you've been involved in it, you know, intimately as a candidate or a campaign coordinator, you don't realize the almost, not quite, but almost insurmountable obstacles that the system throws in front of us, unless you're endorsed by one of the major parties, the Democrats or Republicans, it really is almost impossible to even get on the ballot. And my campaign, I think maybe because of my high profile and the fact that I did have a lot of support in the district, where my campaign was able to, you know, overcome those obstacles. But now here in California, with the top two primary, they've made it almost impossible. The people voted for this and have made it almost impossible for anybody, a third party or independent, to get on the ballot in California, for to give Californians the opportunity to vote for somebody that they that resonates with them. So that's why we need to, and I'm not sure that counts for federal elections, but I would have to check into that more, but it might just be state elections. In our own communities, we have school boards, we have boards of supervisors, we have city councils, and if we could get people with our, you know, our ideology, which really is, I believe, it's the humane, you know, peaceful ideology. If we could do that in most communities in this country, the only way it could go would be up. And you know, we really want to think that the U.S. government has all of this power over us, but we really need to invest our energy and our time into local governments, where that really is where most of the change that affects us happens.
In this edition of Radio Curious, we're visiting with Cindy Sheehan. She is a former candidate for Congress in San Francisco against the then Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi. She's the author of a book called Myth America. You can find that on her website or references to it, CindySheehanSoapbox.com. You're listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Cindy, I'd like to talk with you about your personal political philosophy. You just touched on it a little bit in reference to a humane, peaceful ideology. Can you tell us more?
Well, I believe a very basic philosophy that things like housing, healthcare, education, healthy food, clean access to clean water, are human rights. They're not privileges. In the United States, it's enshrined that these things are privileges, and it's not. They're basic human rights. And a humane political platform would be one that makes those guaranteed, that instead of having health care for profit, we have universal single-payer health care. Education should be free and accessible to anyone from preschool up through university. A job that that pays a living wage, not a minimum wage, is a human right. And there's many countries in this world that are far poorer than the United States that enshrine these as human rights in their constitution. And, you know, specifically Venezuela is one of those countries. And I'm writing a book about Venezuela and the Bolivarian Revolution right now called Revolution, a Love Story. And to make these things human rights instead of human privileges, we have to have a fairer and more equitable income distribution in this country, whether that would be raising taxes on the wealthy, you know, nationalizing some industries that suck the resources dry from our communities, like the military-industrial complex, banking, which has taken up a lot of our resources. There's one aspect. In the new budget that Obama proposed and the Republicans have refined, they're proposing $44 billion in cuts to social services. But $44 billion in the tax cuts to the wealthy per year is in this budget. So if you just eliminated the tax cuts to the wealthy, we could eliminate cutting those social programs. And of course, one of the major, major human rights is to live in a community or a country that's free from occupation, that's free from, you know, illegitimate and illegal invasions. And so that is one of the major, should be one of the major platforms in a political campaign that it is humane. My campaign slogan was people before politics, that every decision that we make has to ensure that, you know, 300 million people in this country aren't left out. But that's usually what the political decisions are. They leave us out and help the people who don't need help, the wealthy, the one percenters that control 90% of the wealth in this country.
How would you describe an United States foreign policy? There's an assumption in my question that you think that there should be one. So I guess we have to visit that first.
How would I describe the current foreign policy?
No, the one in your personal philosophy.
Well, I just did say that, you know, one of the human rights is to live in a country that's free from occupation and invasion. So, you know, our military budget should be dramatically reduced. Instead of, you know, taking up over 50% of the resources in this country, it should be cut down to at least 25% of the resources to be, you know, our military should be something that defends our country and, you know, defends innocent people, not to be invasionary forces for the corporations. And that's something that Smedley Butler addressed back in, you know, Major General Smedley Butler addressed back in the 30s between World War I and World War II. And so, you know, a foreign policy that's humane and peaceful would be one that does not use its military to go around the world wreaking havoc. And that's one that is just for defensive purposes only.
Considering that March 20th marks the 8th anniversary of the Iraq War, can you tell us what is the force or the drive behind your continual activism year after year?
Well, you know, I didn't get into this, into activism to, you know, become famous or to change the face of the U.S. government from, you know, just to switch one party to the next party. I got into this to end the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and those aren't ended. And that's what, you know, I have a goal. I actually have a goal that hasn't been realized. And even after, if the troops do come home from Iraq or Afghanistan, and those misadventures, and you can guarantee that the empire is planning more. So we have to stay in as a peace force to say that no, you know, this foreign policy that the United States government has is insane. It's inhumane. It lacks compassion. It lacks vision. It's all about, you know, just raping and pillaging the planet until there's nothing left. So we just have to stay in it. We have to stay in as that peace force that continually calls our nation and our world to a better place and a better way of problem solving. You know, and I don't know if I'll be successful. I don't know if we'll be successful as the people who have gone before us, you know, haven't, that we still get in these wars, but we can't stop, because I think that this country would be worse off and the planet would be worse off if people didn't try.
When you say the empire is planning more, do you have specifics about plans that you're aware of, or is that based on the past 125-year history of the United States?
You know, well, it's both. It's our history, and it's also, you know, the rhetoric of our government. You know, their rhetoric's always hostile against Iran, against North Korea, against Venezuela, you know, against Libya. Our foreign policy is intimately and too connected to Israel's foreign policy, and it's Israel's domestic policy with their oppression and stealing of Palestinian land. So, you know, there's always something on the back burner or the front burner, and war is for profit. And if we don't have these overt or covert wars, which really haven't stopped, as you pointed out, then how are they going to profit?
That's a rhetorical question. But when you mention certain countries in the Middle East, the rights of women are virtually non-existent.
Well, you know, that's funny, because Iraq was one of the most westernized countries in the Middle East, with women who were university educated. They were doctors, they were lawyers, they were engineers, they, you know, were in every aspect of the government and the society. And so we go over there and decimate the country and change all of that. So I know women in Afghanistan that are fighting for those rights. They're fighting against the Taliban. They're fighting for their rights. And you know what they tell me? We don't need to fight the U.S. occupiers also. So, you know, women are very strong. Women have women here in the United States. Many of my sisters that went before me were beaten, they were jailed, they were killed just because they wanted to vote. So, you know, women have been in this struggle for literally ever. And I think we will be in a struggle until, you know, we reach, you know, equality with our brothers. And, you know, we still don't have equality here in the United States. So, you know, of course, as a woman, we have to be in solidarity with that struggle. But that struggle, us occupying their country and killing their children and killing them, is not contributing to help that struggle.
Cindy Sheehan, how do you economically sustain your efforts?
Well, I write books and I go around and speak, and I have some very generous supporters who help me. And if anybody wants to donate, they can go to CindySheehanSoapbox.com and donate to my cause.
Well, we thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious. And before we close, I'd like to ask you if there is or was a eureka moment in your life where you all of a sudden realized things are different.
Well, the major pivotal point in my life was when my son was killed. And I would like to say my eureka moment was when, you know, I discovered gold or something, but, you know, certainly that isn't it. But I've tried to do the best I can to make that profound pivotal point in my life meaningful to me, to my family, try to make meaning out of Casey's death, something that was so senseless, and then, you know, try to transform it into something that helps other people.
And what would you like to do with the remainder of your one precious life?
Well, I'd like to have a balance between being really involved in my children, my surviving children and grandchildren's lives, and working to make the world better for them.
And finally, Cindy Sheehan, is there a book that you could recommend to our listeners?
I guess one book that really has influenced me a lot in my early activism was Hegemony or Survival by Noam Chomsky.
Well, Cindy Sheehan, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious.
Oh, thank you. It was nice to talk to you.
Cindy Sheehan is an outspoken peace activist and anti-war activist. Cindy Sheehan's book, Myth America, is available free on her website, CindySheehansSoapbox.com. The book that Cindy Sheehan recommends is Hegemony and Survival, America's Quest for Global Dominance by Noam Chomsky. There are over 380 Radio Curious archive editions on our website at radiocurious.org, where all programs are free to download, copy, share, or rebroadcast as you wish. We'd like you to use the whole program and ask that you give credit to Radio Curious. You may also subscribe to our podcast and receive new programs as they are produced. Click the podcast link at radiocurious.org. Let us know if you need a CD. We can make one for you. The email is curious@radiocurious.org. Snail mail may be sent to Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's UKIAH, California, 95482. The phone is 707-462-6541. Christina Onnested is our associate producer. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm host and producer Barry Vogel. Thank you for joining us.